Welcome to Power Play. I'm Evan Solomon. On our program today, reacts to the tax on the unvaxxed.
We have been assured by the Quebec government that they intend to stand by the principles and the rules around the Canada Health Act as they move forward.
Prime Minister does not condemn Quebec's proposal to tax the unvaxxed. Could it violate the Canada Health Act? And with mandatory vaccines coming for all international truckers, how will the federal government ensure there are not shortages around the corner? We're going to ask the international trade minister, Mary Ng, all of those questions next. And then, secure schools?
We believe so strongly that children need to be in school, that they are essential to the mental and physical health of a child and to their academic success.
Did Ontario provide enough details to ensure parents that schools will be safe when in-class learning returns on Monday? Why won't parents even know about a COVID risk until 30% of the class is affected? We're going to ask the Ontario government some of those questions. Plus, housing crisis?
We have an emergency in this country, and it is that our economy has become a gigantic inflated balloon.
What exactly can the federal government do to stop the rocketing cost of housing? How did Canada's housing supply fall so short? MPs are going to debate that, and we'll host them. This is Power Play. Let's get to all the players.
At the federal level, we've taken some very strong level measures. At the provincial levels, they're looking at measures that will work for them. This Quebec proposal is something that obviously everyone is paying attention to right now, but there are still many details to know. And the details will be important in how this works, how it balances the values and the rights that we all cherish as Canadians with the necessity of keeping people safe.
Okay, lots of reaction today to Quebec's proposal to tax the unvaccinated. Is the province also gearing up for another battle over that or not? Look, the tax has already become a political and national lightning rod. Leaders across the country are speaking for it or against it, and some just avoiding it altogether. And to be fair, there are very few details. The premier said it will be a significant health care contribution to be paid by unvaccinated adults. What that will be, how it will work, we still don't know. The Quebec government says more than 7,000 people, though, were so worried about whatever this thing turns out to be that they actually registered for their first dose of COVID-19 vaccines yesterday. So maybe it's just all rhetoric to get people to get vaccinated. If so, something happened on that. Quebec also announced its plan for the tax. That's 2,000 more people that got vaccinated than the previous day. Last week, remember, the federal health minister, Jean-Yves Duclos, said Canada should have a national conversation about mandatory vaccines. So does the federal government support Quebec's idea in principle? And the federal government has their own new vaccine mandate coming in just a few days. Cross-border truckers are all going to need to prove that they have the shots by January 15th. But thousands don't. Will this lead to supply chain shortages? And what will the federal government do to keep those supply chains intact? Let's find out. Joining me now is the International Trade Minister, Mary Ng. Minister, good to see you and Happy New Year. We got to start in Quebec, where the government is proposing this healthcare contribution. They're calling it. It's a tax on the unvaxxed. Now, I know there's no details yet available, but does the federal government in general have concerns about a province deciding to use the single-payer public health care system as a way to punish the unvaccinated?
Well, Evan, Happy New Year to you. It's really terrific to talk to you. We know that vaccinations are really important and they do work. We are seeing Omicron all across the country, indeed all around the world. It's really important that people get vaccinated. I know that both the Prime Minister and my colleague, the Health Minister, spoke about this a little earlier in the day. I won't be saying more than what they've already said, which is that we are looking at what Quebec is doing as part of their proposal. But look, I mean, what we do agree with is the universality of the healthcare system and the importance of the Canada Health Act. And maybe I'll just leave it there because I know my colleague who is working on this and who has the lead on this,
right.
You know, we'll have something to say when, you know, when, right. when they do.
I know, but like, this is a big thing. This is causing a huge amount of consternation. There's worry about the slippery slope. Could the public health care system be used in one way? We all recognize that that the 10% of the population who are not vaxxed are taking up a disproportionate number of seats, beds in the hospital system and the ICUs. The Prime Minister didn't even condemn this idea. He even said provinces are right to think about it. So again, just in general, is the government say it's okay to slap a specific tax on those who are not vaxxed? Is that acceptable?
I think what the Prime Minister and both the Prime Minister and the Health Minister said that is that we are very much looking at this and just as you would expect us to do, to understand the details and to provide a, you know, a thoughtful response when, you know, when we are able to do that. But today at that same press conference, I was there to talk to Canadian small businesses about extending the deadline, making the deadline for the Canada Emergency Business Loan repayable at the end of 2023. I, this is really important because in light of Omicron, in light of our continuing fight against the pandemic, businesses have talked to me directly, they've talked to our government directly, and I'm really pleased that today we're able to provide that extension that they have asked for so that they can get the flexibility that they need to keep fighting this pandemic and to keep operating their businesses.
Okay, but look, these are related issues. You have to do that because the pandemic is going on, and the pandemic's being extended, and businesses are shut down because our hospital systems are threatening to be overwhelmed. And then your colleague on the panel today, the health minister, had talked about mandatory vaccinations for the provinces. No one understands what he's talking about, so maybe you can interpret it. When he's saying it's time to look at a mandatory vaccination, mandatory, that's different than a vaccine passport. What exactly is he talking about? What idea is he floating there?
Well, I don't want to speak for my colleague, who certainly has both carriage for the file and the expertise. What I will say, though, is, you know, to your point about small businesses and to all businesses in the country, it's really important that we continue to support their efforts. We are continuing to fight this pandemic. We've been there from day one to make sure that they have the supports. In fact, we had already planned to make sure that supports were in place when we passed legislation to make sure that they're in December, to make sure that there is lockdown support for workers and for businesses so our hardest hit businesses can continue to get the support that they need, whether it's to keeping people on the payroll or to pay things like rent. And this is the work that I continue to do in the small business side.
I get it, but you got to be talking to the minister. I mean, you can't say, well, I'll leave it for him. He's floating the idea of mandatory vaccinations. Your work is, you're part of a team here. I just don't want you to duck what you're saying. Clearly, you have a cabinet meeting where you're figuring this out. When he floated that idea, I'm asking you as the minister, because then you've got to come out and say, boy, this is still going on. I've got to extend support for businesses. What do you think he meant when he talked about provinces looking at mandatory vaccinations? What's he talking about?
Well, I think what we're talking about writ large is the importance of vaccinations, the importance of Canadians getting boosted, working as we have been with the provinces and territories to get the support to them that they need so that they can, you know, so that they can support Canadians and that they can ensure that their systems are, you know, are supporting Canadians, particularly those that are finding themselves in hospitals and needing the care of, you know, frontline healthcare workers and so forth. I mean, the Prime Minister has had some 35 meetings with his First Minister colleagues precisely to keep doing this, you know, precisely to keep doing this work. So what we're talking about is, and I would say to, you know, to your viewers who are watching, vaccines work, boosters work. For those who have not yet had their vaccine, please go and get it. And I know that the healthcare workers will appreciate that because we're all in this fight together.
Okay. I appreciate that. You know, you didn't answer the question about mandatory vaccinations. We know vaccinations are important. The whole question here is compliance and how to get the 10%. Okay, let me just move on. We understand Prince Edward Island has now asked the federal government for support from the Red Cross for the vaccine rollout. Can you give us any details on that?
Kevin, I don't have the specifics on that. I'm happy to get back to you on that particular request. Again, as the small business minister and the international trade minister, the work that I continue to do, of course, is to make sure that our businesses across the country get the support that they need to weather through the storm in this pandemic, to make sure that they are paying or repaying their loans or not having to do that until 2023. Because remember, there's a forgivable part of that loan that is really important for businesses. They are looking for that. They're looking for that flexibility to pay. So as the small business minister, making sure that they are supported all across the country is the work that I and my team does every day in an effort to fight this pandemic.
Here's something that's directly in your file. The vaccine mandate on cross-border truckers comes into effect January 15th. The Canadian Trucker Association says this will sideline 16,000 truckers and put a wicked strain on the supply chain. That's 10% of the force. What is the government, federal government, doing to protect those supply chains?
Yeah, you know what? Really important question. Let me start by sending a thank you to the heroic work that the truckers have been doing. Look, throughout this pandemic, we have relied on them and their work to get, to keep ourselves stocked and make sure that our supply chains, in fact, and the goods are moving across, across borders and throughout the country. So we are definitely doing that work. This work, we are working very hard to make sure that the supply chains continue to be resilient. It's a whole government approach. I work with my colleagues in,
Specifically, I get that, but specifically, January 15th, there's mandatory vaccine passports coming. I get it. The Trucking Alliance is saying you're going to lose 16,000 trucks, 16,000 drivers, 10% of the, or 12,000 rather, 10% of the workforce. So, or actually, I think it's 16,000. What specifically will the Canadian government do? You're mandating this to mitigate supply chain shortfalls and therefore higher prices.
Well, we've been working with the industry precisely to, make sure that our supply chains are not going to be disrupted. I mean, that is the work that we're doing. But remember, we're also balancing against the other really important work that all of us are doing, which is fighting COVID-19, keeping Canadians safe. So that work has to be balanced against keeping Canadians safe and making sure that. That our supply chains continue to be resilient as they have been.
So I know you got to go. But just last question. So should we expect on January 15th there's going to be good supply shortages because of the trucks? Like you're saying, it's a balance, so something's got to give here. Should we expect shortages of goods because of the vaccine mandate and increased prices? Is that something that Canadians should expect?
No, not at all. I think what Canadians should expect their government to do, which is what we're doing, is to work with the industry, make sure that Canadians stay safe, and work to keep supply chains.
But where are the drivers going to come from? That's all. Like, are there 10,000 extra drivers around?
Well, this is work that we're doing right now, and we're working with the industry very, very hard and steadfastly. We're taking a whole-of-government approach to this. So absolutely, I mean, making sure that people get vaccinated. I would still encourage everyone, who isn't vaccinated to go and get vaccinated. They work, and they're going to help us keep fighting this COVID, this pandemic.
All right, Minister, I got to leave it there. I really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Good. Thanks so much, Evan.
Okay, so that, of course, is Minister Ng on that. I don't know. We'll find out about those shortages. They say a whole-of-government approach. I don't know what that means. Schools are back in Ontario on Monday, but are schools actually safer? Ontario Education Minister Stephen Lecce made his long-anticipated appearance to give an update on the new measures. Check this out.
As we adapt to this pandemic, we are building on our past investments and our efforts to protect against COVID-19 by bolstering rising rates of youth vaccine, significant ventilation improvements in all publicly funded schools, and high-quality PPE for students and staff.
Okay, so let's look at some of those issues, how they're doing it. They've got students and staff. School staff will receive two rapid antigen tests, two upon their return on Monday. Is that enough? The government says about 10 million N95 masks are being sent out to educators. How many are there now? We don't know. 4 million three-ply masks for students. They're going to ship an additional 3,000 air filters to school, these HEPA filters, on top of the 7,000 previously shipped. And there will be school-based vaccination clinics in some locations to bolster vaccine uptake in kids. They're also going to have stricter screening requirements, including daily on-site confirmation of COVID screening. But concerns were raised today over plans to only notify parents of classroom infections when, get this, only 30% of teachers and students are absent. So now, just literally minutes ago, the province just sent us a note saying, no, there will actually be a new reporting website where parents can access absentee data before that 30% threshold is met. Why is there so much confusion when we're just days away of sending kids back to school? Did the Ontario government manage to use these past 2 weeks successfully? Let's find out. Ontario's Parliamentary Assistant to the Attorney General, Donna Skelly, joins us. MPP Skelly, always good to have you on the program. Let's just start with this. Today, parents were only going to be notified if there's an outbreak with 30% absenteeism. That caused an enormous amount of consternation. Now parents have to log in and check. Why this confusing change suddenly?
Well, first of all, nice to see you, Evan. This policy and this plan that we've implemented is consistent with every other jurisdiction in the country. What we are doing is bringing forward layers of protection to do what we believe is make schools as safe as we possibly can. We want kids back in the classroom. We know parents want them back in the classroom. And as you mentioned, we have introduced a plethora of new measures to keep our students safe. The ability to bring two rapid tests home per student is one additional measure. If a student or a family member has been exposed to a COVID-19 positive person, or if they are showing symptoms of COVID, they can take the test. They've only been given two because of the number of tests that we have available. Of course, we're still waiting on a shipment of 50 million tests from the federal government. They haven't arrived. But trust me, the minute they arrive in Ontario, they are right out the door. And of course,
more tests will come. But just focus on this. I just want to drill down on this. The Ontario government originally said if one kid in a class of, let's call it a class of 30, average class size, goes home, is absent because of a COVID test, kids and parents wouldn't be notified. And not until 9 kids in that class would they be notified. But now you're saying parents have to log on every day, and how is this going to work now? Because like if my kid's in a class and someone's exposed to COVID, I'm not going to know until 8 other kids may be exposed?
We would like to be able to, first of all, let's go back with this particular variant. We know it is so widespread and it is highly transmissible. And the previous variant really was much easier to track, but by having a limited number of PCR tests, it's more difficult to really track this particular variant. We are doing what we can by allowing families to do what they can to keep their children from going to school if they feel that they have the variant or if they have been exposed to COVID-19 in general. But as I said, this is a policy that is consistent across Ontario. We also said that with the HEPA ventilation system, we track all of the maintenance and the inspections of our ventilation in every school in Ontario. Those are publicly posted. Okay. You have to track that to see the results of each school.
Just for time. So on Monday, I just wanted two quick questions. Is your government guaranteeing that every teacher will have an N95 mask on Monday and every classroom is going to have a HEPA filter on Monday?
We have sent out and had procured enough N95 masks for every teacher, and not just teachers, every person who works in the school system, custodians, bus drivers, etc. They'll have access to an N95 mask, as well as the three-ply masks for the students. And in terms of the HEPA filtrations, our schools are always checked. They're monitored for the ventilation. This isn't something that we've just done in the past few weeks. These ventilation systems were installed back in September, prior to the beginning of the September school year. We've added an additional 3,000. Every school has a HEPA ventilation system, and we're continuing to make improvements to all of the ventilation systems in every school in the province. That's an ongoing basis.
Look, we know the vaccination rate in Ontario, children, lags behind provinces like Newfoundland and Labrador that had school-based clinics. Your government's finally doing that. You didn't do it weeks ago. But some are saying, look, maybe it's time to take steeper measures. Is your province at all, looking at or considering something like the Premier of Quebec is talking about, a tax on the unvaxxed?
I have to say no. We believe that it's more important to encourage people, show them the evidence that the way to get through this is by getting more shots in the arms. We believe in a positive message and a positive approach. I hope we don't have to go down that road. At this point, we're doing, and you mentioned the province of Newfoundland. They lead the country right now in vaccination numbers for children 5 to 11, and we are taking a page from their book and bringing in clinics to schools with the approval of your parents, you can now get a child between 5 and 11 will be able to get a vaccine at a clinic in an elementary school. But no, at this point, we believe that a positive message, encouraging them and showing the evidence is the best route to follow.
All right, I got to leave it there. We'll find out what happens Monday. Big day for millions and millions of kids. MPP Donna Skelly, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Anytime.
Coming up, the skyrocketing price of housing. What exactly can the federal government do to slow it down? MPs gathered today for their first committee meeting, and now they're gathered here for the debate next. Stay with us. Welcome back. It may be freezing outside, but Canada's housing market, red hot. That's no surprise to any Canadian looking to get into the housing market. The Bank of Canada recently updated its housing price affordability index. Not a good picture there. Showed Canadians will now need to spend, get this, 37% of their disposable income to service a mortgage. 37%. The affordability index hasn't been that high since 2008. Scotiabank also just released a report today showing how much of a crunch there is in Canada's housing supply. Canada lags behind in the G7 when it comes to housing stock supply, even adjusted for inflation. How do things look by province? Pretty bad. Canada's most populous province, Ontario, falls to the back of the pack alongside Alberta. Get this. Ontario would need to add over 650,000 new homes, and Alberta would have to add 138,000 new units just to catch up with the rest of the country, and the rest of the country is last in the G7. So that's the backdrop for today's Finance Committee convening early to address Canada's housing inflation crisis. But with the pandemic and the global supply chain disruptions driving up inflation, what exactly can and should the federal government do in the short term to help Canadians get into the market? What's driving up the price? Let's get our panel of MPs. Rachel Bendayan is the Parliamentary Secretary to the Associate Finance Minister. Pierre Poilievre is the Conservative Finance Critic. And Daniel Blakey is the NDP's Finance Critic. Welcome, everyone. Happy New Year. Good to see you all. Ms. Bendayan, I'll start with you. Your government has indicated plans to create more affordable housing through the Housing Affordability Fund as a response. You and I both know that won't come close to adding the supply needed. Building more units in the mid to long-term solution. So just specifically, what will your government do in the short term to address the housing inflation problem?
Well, thanks, Evan. And let me just first acknowledge that, the situation in Quebec is also dire. Just on Monday night, there was a homeless man, I believe he was 74 years old, who died outside in Montreal overnight. And our government is absolutely aware of the issue and committed to solving it. So far, we've housed over a million Canadians. This is a $72 billion housing program that we've put together. But Evan, you touched on something that I find very interesting. Supply is absolutely one side of this issue, and our programs, many of them are committed to creating new constructions, renovating old buildings in order to create more supply. Just today, Minister Hussein with Minister Boissonneau and Mayor Sohi announced new constructions out in Edmonton, Alberta. But I also want to talk about what we can do in order to bring down some of the unproductive demand in the housing market. There are many levers at our disposal. We have put forward a number of very interesting measures, and I'm disappointed to say that the Conservatives voted against many of them. We would like to institute a tax on foreign buyers, non-residents who are coming to scoop up Canadian homes. The Conservatives voted against that. We would like to make sure that foreign buyers are banned from doing that in the future entirely. And we're also putting together concrete measures in order to stop rent evictions, which we know are causing families to get kicked out of their apartments. And so I think there are, on both the supply and the demand side, some interesting proposals on the table.
Okay, Mr. Polyever, you wanted this committee meeting. What do you think the federal government can and should do to alleviate this kind of wicked pressure on the market?
Well, the first thing is what they should stop doing. What we've seen in Canada's housing prices over the last 2 years is a 30% increase in the price, even while the wages and GDP that pay for housing have dropped. So where's the money coming from? Where is the money coming from for the $200 billion increase in the number of houses purchased year over year in 2021? Where is the money coming from to double the number of mortgages to investor purchasers? Where is the money coming from to pay for a record year over year increase in house prices? The answer is that the government is printing the money and pouring that cash into the financial markets, which is being lent out at well below the rate of inflation, which means that people are effectively being paid, investors, wealthy investors are effectively being paid to borrow money and balloon housing prices. Ms. Bendayen talks about all these wonderful initiatives that her government is doing. It hasn't worked. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. I'm proud to say I voted against everything this government has done on housing, because what they have done is inflated the second worst housing bubble in the world, behind only New Zealand, according to Bloomberg. And we have the most housing inflation of any G7 country. So this government, first of all, needs to stop inflating the housing market before this bubble bursts and blows up our economy.
Okay, let me go to Mr. Blakey. And I know, Mr. Blakey, is that the same diagnosis that you have? And I know we talked about the government printing money. I just want to make sure people are aware, the Bank of Canada and the monetary policy. Mr. Polyever, you can clarify that after. Is it the low interest rates or not? But let me just bring in Mr. Blakey to see if you believe that's the same diagnosis, and what would your solution be?
Well, I mean... In terms of the problem in the housing market, the biggest driver right now is the financialization of housing. And so, I think there is a question about the extent to which the liquidity that government provided to banks has been turned around and used in order to drive investment in the housing market. And to the extent that that's true, that really is a problem. You know, we had called at the beginning of the pandemic for a much firmer hand with the banks on the part of the government to make sure that extra fiscal room that the banks were being granted was going to be used to provide mortgage relief for Canadians. And that didn't happen in the way that it really ought to have. So then the question is, well, what were the banks doing with that money? And obviously some of that has been invested in the real estate market. So that is one of the things at play that has to be addressed. But from a historical perspective, this really hot housing market isn't something new. This is something that's been going on for a long time in Canada now, including before the pandemic. Some of the immediate things that government could be doing right now, as far as we're concerned, I mean, one of the things we've heard from nonprofit groups that want to build affordable housing and indeed social housing is that they just can't compete with these investors that have a bunch of cash on hand, because their current model is to, you know, see land or buildings that are available, and then they have to chase the cash. And that process takes too long. So a government could set up a fund that would enable, nonprofits with good track records on building affordable and social housing to be able to snap up land and buildings when they become available. And the other thing that they might consider doing, we've seen New Zealand do, is to say, you know, once you have your primary residence, once you have your first property, when you go to the bank for a mortgage, you should be asked to put more down on each successive property so that the initial down payment isn't the same.
Okay, that's
sorry, Evan, go ahead.
Then Diane, and then Mr. Polyevra, can you react to those things?
Well, I mean, Evan, one of the things that I would like to say, both to Mr. Polyevra but to the Conservatives generally, is that I don't see the reason for this obsession about talking down the Canadian economy. Why turn away investment at such a critical point in Canadians' lives? And especially since we know that the economy is doing quite well. We had 4.5% growth last quarter. We've recovered all of the jobs lost during the pandemic.
I don't want to get caught in politics, but there is a fair point. Whatever's being done ain't working. The housing market's blowing up. And I guess the question is, how do Canadians trust that any of the solutions that you're proposing will actually bring it down?
Well, we put forward during the campaign, in our platform, a number of brand new measures that haven't been tested yet. An anti-flipping tax is one of them that I think will be extremely important going forward. I've mentioned already the importance of excluding foreign buyers from scooping up Canadian homes. And Canadians agree with that approach. Let us try those measures and let us move forward in a concrete way in order to attack the housing affordability crisis.
Mr. Polyevra, the governor of the Bank of Canada has indicated the central bank will raise key interest rates this year. Will that be enough to cool down the market?
Well, we're in a very dangerous spot, Evan. When you inflate a balloon and then you try to pop the balloon, then you end up with a crisis. We saw that in 2008 in the United States. So we don't know whether they will now be able to undo the damage they've done. Everything comes from somewhere and nothing comes from nowhere. Somehow, an extra $200 billion in annual home purchases flooded into the market in 2021. That's an 80% increase. Where did that money come from? Obviously, real dollars had to purchase those houses. Mr. Blakey is right. The very wealthy who can access the cash from the banking system were able to get it in record numbers, a 100% increase in mortgage lending to the investor class in a single year, according to the Bank of Canada. That money has inflated a massive bubble. Now the question is
it's not a bubble. I'm just to be fair.
No,
like
I don't know which expert
the CMHC
you're
said it's
sorry.
Not a bubble. Well,
I
did talk to David Dodge, the former Bank of Canada governor.
Right.
He didn't say there was a bubble.
Evan.
Yes.
You're going to want to expunge those comments from the record when this bubble bursts, because we are in serious trouble right now. Our house prices have outstripped incomes at a dramatic pace that is unrivaled by any other country in the world or by any other time in our history. And if we do not moderate these prices quickly and get our incomes back up to the level of growth in our house prices, this bubble is going to burst, and anybody who said today that it wasn't a bubble will have as much egg on their face as the people who told us we'd have no inflation.
If I might just jump in here, Evan,
I'm heavy here, so Mr. Blakey, if you keep it short, I'll give you the last word real quick.
Sure. So, I mean, what I would say really quickly is that, one of the other things that we have to address here is that part of the reason that there's a surplus of investment capital that's being funneled into the real estate market too has to do with, we had the PBO put out a report saying that 1% of the population now controls 25% of the wealth. They don't know what to do with it all. And that's partly a product of serious slashing of the corporate tax rate and other forms of taxation for the wealthiest Canadians over the last 25 or more years now. And that's part of what's also contributing to the capital that's inflating prices. And until we get a handle on that, there's going to be a very small amount of people with a lot of money not knowing what to do with it and wanting to multiply that money to keep up with the Joneses in the gated communities. And that's a real problem that has to be addressed as well.
Okay, the good news is the Finance Committee is at least going to meet 10 times to talk about this. It's a real issue, and I hope that we can keep hosting you, all of you, to have a really good discussion about this. It's a vital issue. There's babies that it's going on. It's great. We're all at home. We're all trying to deal with this. Rachel Ben-Dayan, Pierre Polyever, Daniel Blakey. I think that might be Mr. Polyever's new baby. By the way, congratulations on that.
It's actually my three-year-old. My three-year-old, actually. Okay. But thank you, Evan. I appreciate it.
All right, I want to say thanks to all
me.
Of you.
She's heckling me. I'm not even in the House of Commons, and I'm being heckled in my own house.
You probably like it. You probably like it. All right, coming up, Quebec's anti-vax tax. Would it be legal? Check this out.
Like people across the country, we've received that proposal with interest by the Quebec government, but there's a lot more details that we have to hear on how this would work.
Will this tax for the unvaccinated hold up in court? We'll find out. The Canadian Civil Liberties Association joins us on the press gallery next. Stay with us. So the Quebec premier is proposing a tax on the unvaxxed. We don't know the details, and the prime minister was asked about it today. He said he needs more details to comment, but he did say various levels of government are right to look at different ways of encouraging and incentivizing people to get vaccinated, and that, quote, strong measures have worked in keeping Canadians safe. So he didn't condemn it. Is that an indication that he's on board with the plan or not? Is it just federal politicians saying, hey, we do not want to get involved in Quebec politics? The press guy is going to weigh in on the potential impact and legality of this. Carl Dockstader, the co-host of One Dish, One Mic, and the executive director of the Niagara Regional Native Center. Emily Nicolas is a columnist with Le Devoir. And our special guest is Kara Zwiebel. She's the director of the Fundamental Freedoms and Acting General Counsel at the Civil Liberties Association. Happy New Year, everyone. Kara, let me just start with you. You're calling on the Quebec government to abandon their tax penalty on the unvaccinated. We don't even know the details yet. Would it be legal? Would it breach the charter?
I mean, it's really hard to assess with the very few details that we have. But, you know, there is, like you said, you know, this is, you could call it an attempt to incentivize vaccination. You might also call it an attempt to coerce or compel vaccination. And, you know, although the government has framed it as a tax, I think realistically it's more a fine. It's more akin to a fine. And so there are constitutional problems when you are, you know, trying to interfere with bodily autonomy. And I think that we need to know what it is that the government's trying to achieve, because that's one of the things that courts look at when they're assessing whether, you know, limits on our rights are reasonable or not. And we just don't really know that at this point.
Emily, what's the reaction? I know it's going to be popular, and yeah, there's a political element in Quebec that you can explain to us, of course, because the premier's very politically strategic on that stuff. But what are the questions it's raising in Quebec?
I think one of the questions that I have, and I know that I'm not the only one that has that question, is, you know, what questions does it pose to the principle of universality in the Canadian Health Care Act? There has been examples of health taxes before. The Jean Charest Liberal government did that. There are some, I think, an example in Ontario as well. Used to be, you know, some sort of a measure through your tax report that you would have an extra contribution to the healthcare system. However, those kind of taxes were never based on something in your medical record. And I think that's the new element here, is that depending on something in your medical file, you're going to pay more or less. Contribute more or less to the healthcare system. That's the system that private health insurance have. That's how they determine how much you pay per month, right, for your insurance. And so that, to me, and to a lot of other people who have been voicing their concerns, especially people who are themselves healthcare professional, that's a breach of the spirit of universality in healthcare. And so I don't know if it's going to be legal, but just in spirit, it seems to be, you know, weakening the principle that the healthcare system is for everyone and people pay depending on what they can pay, not depending on how sick they are or whether or not they've been vaccinated or not against certain diseases.
And Carl, as a frequent contributor on this program, Zane Velji said today, this is not just a tax on the anti-vaxxers, a kind of hardened community. It's on the unvaccinated, which would include a lot of communities that for various reasons, maybe marginalized communities, are not vaccinated. What's your take on this?
Yeah, I mean, you can show statistically that Indigenous people are vaccinated at lower rates than non-Indigenous people. So already this is an automatic tax against Indigenous people in places like Quebec. But I think this is just more of the same. Zane Velji was talking on the weekend about how Prime Minister Trudeau had painted the broad brush of misogynists and racists being the anti-vaxxers. And I think it's a way of skipping away from the very difficult conversation of why is there so much mistrust in the medical health system, particularly in places like the Indigenous community. Is Premier Legault going to have that conversation ever? I don't think that's going to happen in Quebec.
Oh, okay. So just last word to you, Kara. So then what? Like, we're going to get the details. Do you expect legal challenges to this based on what Emily's talking about? Universality, privacy, enforcement, on what level?
Yeah, I think it's very likely that if the government actually, you know, carries through with this, that there will be legal challenges. Certainly it's something we would consider, depending on, you know, how this is supposed to work. And I think for sure there will be people who will, you know, be subject to these fines. They will not pay them. Then we need to find out what the government intends to do in those circumstances. Will you go to jail, essentially, because you refuse to be vaccinated or won't be vaccinated and won't pay the tax? You know, that brings things to another level in terms of the Constitution. So I do expect this will be before the courts if it does, if they do follow through on this threat.
Right. We understand that no one's going to be turned away from medical care. But then the question is, how do they pay and how it's enforced? So the details, the devil's in the details on this. All right, Kara Zwiebel, great to have you on the program. I really appreciate your perspective. I know Carl and Emily are going to stick around. We have to take a short break right now, but when we come back, we're going to dig back into the housing market. It's red hot. We're going to have Generation Squeeze founder Paul Kershaw join us. What are some solutions to bring down the cost of housing? Stay with us. So finance MPs met earlier today to finally discuss the housing crisis. What can the federal government do to cool it down? Are there any levers? They're going to meet 10 times. This is going to be one of the big issues politically. So the press gallery is going to weigh in on what they're looking for and how this is going to play out politically. Carl Dockstader, co-host of One Dish, One Mike, is back. So is Emily Nicolas, columnist for Le Devoir. And we're bringing in Paul Kershaw, the founder of Generation Squeeze, who's got his own proposal. Okay, we've got a quick rapid-fire round. Paul, I'll start with you. First of all, what do you make of the debate around it? People say, you know, there's a housing bubble and the political debate and the solutions that they're not talking about.
Well, first off, I think when Mr. Poilievre talks about our need to moderate home prices, I think it would be great if the Conservatives and Liberals could come together and say the following. To restore affordability for all, we need home prices to stall so that earnings can catch up. And I think that's what Mr. Poilievre means when he says we need home prices to moderate. I can't predict the future about whether there's a bubble or not, but I darn well know there is no affordability if we don't stop these home prices from continuing to rise. And I think it's great that we have the Finance Committee exploring this issue. And I hope...
But what aren't they talking about?
Exactly. I hope, though, one of several things that they will talk about is that partly we have this problem of skyrocketing home prices because our tax policy induces it. When we shelter home values from taxation, we incentivize Canadians to be happy when home prices rise and leave earnings behind. Just like an offshore tax shelter incentivizes Canadians to move their assets offshore, so a tax shelter on housing does the same for home ownership. It's a political explosion, it's like a grenade to touch the issue, but we are proposing for the aristocracy, as Mr. Poilievre has suggested, for those like me, who I now live in a $2.2 million home, come ask me to contribute more so we can put a downward pressure on high and rising home prices and use the revenue we raise to invest in deeply affordable, cooperative, and purpose-built rental housing.
Okay, let me just go back to you, Emily. So you got Paul saying, look, he's a professor and he's living in a $2 million home because in Vancouver, the house price shoots up. They want an annual surtax. No politician in their right mind's touching taxing primary residents because it's the third rail. Do they have any options out there that are realistic, Emily?
Well, I think if we want to examine options, we need to name one thing. You cannot reduce the price of houses for the new generation to come in the housing market without that being against the interests of the people who've made a lot of money by housing prices going up. So that's why it's so hard to touch and to fix politically, because at the end of the day, the interests of the class of people who are already homeowners are not very easily reconcilable, let's put it this way, with the people who are not on the housing market already. And so there is no way to make houses more affordable without touching the value that some people are really happy to have as the value of their homes. And so if we're not going to have this conversation politically and just pretend that we can make every Canadian happy without making a really tough choice about that, I don't know what kind of conversation we're going to have.
Carl, what's your take on the politics of this and how it's playing out?
Yeah, I think Emily hit the nail on the head again. Just like with all the topics we discuss here, there are no quick fixes. There are no silver bullets that are going to have easy answers. But again, I have to highlight Indigenous women and programs like Homeward Bound that service Indigenous women, wraparound programs, and how much more difficult those programs are when we see housing prices doubling and tripling in areas outside of Toronto, like Niagara. But we have to have that conversation. Who exactly is being hurt the most by this policy, and where should we target help? Where should we build stock, and what specifically can be done to remedy this?
Yeah, but Paul, you know, homeowners are saying, don't touch my retirement. I mean, I get it, it's gone up. And they will revolt against a politician that is going after their primary asset that they've spent 25 years paying off, their home.
Yeah, so 2 points on that. First, we designed this tax proposal so that it would only impact 10% of Canadians, the 10% living in the most affluent homes in the country. I know in Metro Vancouver and the GTA, you might think everyone lives in a $1 million home. That's not the case. And so if you're in a $1 million plus home like I am, you're in the top 10%. And I do think we can ask people in that group to show allegiance to the Canadian dream that a good home should be in reach for what hard work earns, whether it's a rental, in co-op, or yes, maybe even in ownership. And a modest price on housing inequity can help us do that, just like a price on pollution discourages carbon emissions, just like a price on tobacco discourages smoking, just like a price to some degree on being unvaccinated might also help change those incentives. We need to change the incentives in the system. And I'm all for someone saying, I bought my home and I had a large mortgage, and over time I paid off my mortgage and that's how I built up my equity. Have at it. That's me too. I have a $500,000 mortgage. I'm still doing that. But if you're hoping your home's going to go up by 50%, 100%, more than that as part of your investment savings strategy for retirement, then that's a plan for unaffordability for those who follow. And we need to say that's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. And so Emily's right. Emily's right about everything except I think the idea of home prices stalling could be at least a medium meeting space for people. That's not going to hurt people's equity per se, but it is an opportunity to find some common ground.
Well, the word of this panel is Emily's right. Emily, good stuff. You win the panel today. Carl, Emily, and Paul,
thank you.
Great to have you on the program. Listen, we're going to have lots more of this debate coming up, of course, in the days ahead. But that is your Power Play Day in politics. Thanks for watching. Hug your loved ones. See you in 23.